I'd like to introduce to you Dr. Arend J. Pohl-Arends, or Dr. AJ, as he's affectionately known on campus. He's an associate professor of physics and astronomy here at Wheaton College. He got his bachelor's of science in applied physics at the University of Twente, it's in the Netherlands. And then he did a master's in science in physics and astronomy, and then a PhD in astrophysics at the University of Utrecht, also in the Netherlands. Then, for some wild reason, he came to the U.S., and he actually did an MDiv, a master's of divinity at Covenant Theological Seminary down St. Louis way, and had a special focus on hermeneutics and science and faith. And his research interests are actually in, he's in a computational astrophysicist, which means he models things on a computer, and the things that he's mostly interested in are stars and the evolution of stars, and lots of cool things that he won't talk about tonight about that, but maybe on some other future ASA meeting we'll talk about stars and Dr. AJ back. But he's also quite interested in the detection of exoplanets and has been involved in that with our telescope up on the roof of this building. Coming up soon, there will be a science symposium that will be talking about exoplanets, so you'll get more information about that in the future. But he's also very interested in the intersection or relationship between science and faith and theology. He's spoken at several LaBrie events on that kind of intersection, and he will be talking tonight about some ways in which that connects with a particular kind of question that actually fascinated the planning committee when we were talking about what sort of talks to have this year. He will be talking to us about why cosmologists can't stop talking about God. So, welcome, Dr. AJ.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. This is a topic that I've been thinking about for many, many years, and indeed I've talked about it several times at different venues. But this is kind of a new lecture that I wrote for tonight, so we'll see how it goes. But one of the things that, does this coming through?
Yeah.
Oh, I need to press the button.
Yeah. Turn screen. Yes.
Now it's better. All right. I don't even have to talk so loud.
Too light.
Is that too light?
I think so.
Turn it around
a little bit more, I think.
You know, while AJ is getting that ready, I thought of something I forgot to say, which is these talks that we're hearing on a regular basis are posted to the ASA website. So if you know folks you think would enjoy hearing these lectures in the future, you can go there and you can actually get access to them. We're recording this one tonight, right?
Yep.
Yep.
All right, so I turned it down a little bit, I think. Is it better?
Yeah.
So this is a new lecture that I wrote especially for this occasion. One of the things that you will see is that the slides at the beginning are pretty well developed, at the end they're quite sparse. So that's how far it goes. So this title, like, why can't cosmologists stop talking about God? It's pretty interesting. So you go to the bookstore, and you go to the cosmology section, and or astronomy or whatever section, there's always like a section on science, and the vast majority of books there are cosmology or astronomy. And so you pull a couple of books out, and what do you see? A lot of those books, some of them will be technical, about cosmology and how like the Big Bang went off and how the universe evolved, but a lot of them will actually have kind of existential questions mixed in, or actually are totally devoted to existential questions. So here's just a couple of books. Some of them I have myself, and some of them I don't, but I know about. So here's some prominent astrophysicists and cosmologists. Sean Carroll worked at Caltech. He wrote a great book, The Big Picture. I actually read it to my students. So I'm pretty familiar with that book, and so I have some quotes from him in this lecture as well. Joseph Selby, here's Stephen Hawking, everyone knows about him, obviously. Another Stephen Hawking, Martin Rees, Paul Davies, John Barrow, Paul Davies again, Dorian Cross, learn the scrolls. All those people, whenever you open those books, they're not just talking about cosmology, they're talking about God. And you can, this is only like 9 of those books, yeah, 9. You can have piles and piles and piles of books, generally on a popular level, yeah, where people, where cosmologists don't just talk about cosmology, but they talk about God. Why is it? None of them believes in God. But why do they talk about God? That's a question that kind of fascinated me. Yeah. So like, that's really a cool topic to talk about tonight. So that's what we're going to talk about. So eventually we'll get there why people, why I think that they keep talking about God. But here's a couple of things. Is that coming through? It came through. Here's Stephen Hawking. He died last year. One of the most brilliant astrophysicists, cosmologists ever lived. He wrote this. This is the final sentence of his most popular book, A Brief History of Time. Probably many of you have, I don't know how many people have it. A lot of people have it, but never read it. It's one of those books that you have on your coffee table. So here it is, this last sentence. Not all of people got to the sentence, unless you just skip it over and but this is what he says. He talks about the grand unified theories. However, if you discover a complete theory, it should in time be understandable by everyone, not just by a few scientists. And then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of the question of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we should know the mind of God. Stephen Hawking later confessed that he actually thought about like scratching out his last sentence, but then he realized, and I don't know whether this is anecdotal or that is real, that he really thinks about this, that every time he mentions the word God, his readers' public expands by a factor 2, and every time he enters an equation, a mathematical formula in his books, it drops by a factor 2.
Yes.
So he's kind of like keeping them equal, so the amount of equations and the amount of times that he used the word God. That's kind of the story that goes around. I'm not completely sure whether he really thinks about that, but obviously he writes about God, and he thinks about God. Now, for most of the cosmologists who talk about God, what I said already, they don't believe in God. But over and over and over again, they feel the need to still talk about Him. And why is that? Like, if it's for them an antiquated idea, yeah, that God is something that religious people in the 15th and 16th century or so thought about, why do they still feel the need to talk about God? They still do. And in all the books, He shows up. So that's kind of the question. Here's Sean Carroll. This is in a debate, kind of a verbatim transcript of a debate that he had between himself and William Lane Craig a couple of years ago. It's called God and Cosmology, Existence of God in Light of Contemporary Cosmology. You can find the whole transcript at reasonablefaith.org. That's William Lane Craig's website. This is what he says. Interesting perspective. The discussion we're having tonight about God and cosmology does not reflect the debate that is going on in the professional community. If you go to cosmology conferences, there's a lot of talk about the origin and nature of the universe. But there's no talk about what role God might have played in bringing the universe about it. It's not an idea that is taken seriously. My goal is to explain why we think that. You may or may not agree with me, but at the end you should be able to understand why we cosmologists have this view when it comes down to a conflict between two major fundamental pictures of the world, what philosophers would call ontologies, naturalism and theism. So he says, actually, like we talk, like I write books about God, right? He wrote a big picture where God shows up almost in every chapter. But he says, like, as a professional cosmologist, I don't take the idea very serious. But I still write books about it. And I'm still happy to talk about it. Then he continues, naturalism says that all that exists is one world, the natural world, obeying laws of nature, which science can help to discover. Theism says that in addition to the natural world, there is something else, at the very least, God. Perhaps there are other things as well. And I want to argue that naturalism is far and away the winner when it comes to cosmological explanation. And it comes down to 3 points. First, naturalism works. the accounts for all the data that we see. Second, evidence against theism. And third, theism is not qualified. If you want to read the rest of his arguments, go to that website. But basically what he says, like, there's two different worldviews, naturalism, theism. I'm a naturalist, and so I still have to deal with the people who believe in theism and don't, so that's probably why I talk about God. That's probably one of the arguments that he will say. So, the question, if it's not an idea that's taken seriously, why then do you still talk about it? So here's three options that I have for why people still talk about it. It sells. Right, it sells books, just like self-help New Age books. Second one, debunking misconceptions, shining the light of science into a world of religiosity. Third one, if this works, let's just pull this thing over here. Oh. There's really something there. And I think all of them have some value. And so I'll just go through all of them to see where we get. So it sells, the first one. So there's a demand for it, right? There's a demand for like books about cosmology. So a lot of people just want to know how the universe works, right? There's a sense of human curiosity about how the universe works. And so that's one of the reasons why people write books. That's one of the reasons why, for example, like New Age people write books. They want to know about how the universe works, want to know meaning and purpose and that kind of stuff. A lot of it is motivated by human curiosity. And to a certain extent, the search for meaning and purpose. Even in Christian circles, you have like Rick Warren, right? The Purpose Driven Life. It's a book about meaning and purpose, and it's a bestseller. And so a lot of people want to know about those kind of different things. And so there's a sense in which, like, yeah, there's just a commercial interest writing about those different kind of things. So people are learning for meaning. And to a certain extent, they're looking for to science, right? There's a sense in this society right now that science has maybe not all the answers, but a lot of the answers. And so looking to science for those kind of questions. And then cosmology in particular, because cosmology is this science of all the big ultimate questions, right? How did we come here? Where are we going? What is the nature and origin of this universe? What is the place of humans in this universe? All those really, really big questions that people just long to ask. Cosmology kind of deals with those questions and tries to answer them. And so if cosmology is able to answer some of those questions, maybe it's able to answer some of the questions of meaning and purpose as well. That's sometimes a little bit of an idea there. Let's develop that a little further. I'm a little annoyed with this thing. So pull this one out. Here's a philosopher called Charles Taylor. Some of you might know him, some of you might never have heard of him. He's a Roman Catholic philosopher who has written a really, really big book. It's about this thing. It's called The Secular Age. And in that book, he kind of tries to understand why this world is a secular world. Now, when I talk about secular worlds, it is often we think about people are religious or people are secular. And that's one of the ways in which he describes secular. But the really that way that he understands a secular world is a world where religion and non-religion and all kind of different ways that people believe are basically at the same level playing field. And so there's kind of a competition. Yeah, so that's kind of his way of thinking about secular. It's not just that people don't believe anymore. It is that people can believe in all kind of different ways. All kind of different things. That's the way that he describes the secular age. And that's the way that he describes the world that we live in right now. And so he tries to understand how we come about and how we live in this world where people have all kind of different and competing ideas about religion, different competing ideas about meaning and purpose. Where it was like about 400, 500, 600 years ago, it wasn't even a question for people that you could actually have different ideas and different opinions on that. Everyone believed in God. Well, now people can believe in all kind of different things. So he kind of traces this development of like almost like a universal sense of religion and a universal almost Christianity to a certain extent to basically the world that we live in right now, where there's lots and lots of different competing worldviews, different competing religions, so to say. So this is part of his argument. I'm just condensing it very, very quickly, especially towards the topic that I want to talk about tonight. So his claim is that meaning was originally located in the cosmos. Yeah, so the way that people in like the medieval times thought about meaning and purpose, it was located in the cosmos, because the cosmos was the creation of God. Yeah, and so it was creation of God, so meaning was located there, and there were so many things that kind of transcended this world. So God himself, obviously, but also all important things. The natural world itself also was not just the natural world, but it was something that pointed beyond itself, the glory and majesty of God. And a society itself was grounded in a higher reality. So society itself, for example, the kingdoms here on this earth, were not just kingdoms by themselves, if we think about them like nation states or states right now, but they were actually grounded in like in God's kingdom, so to say. And so this was a reality, this was a society that was at all different levels, where basically there was a connection between like the way that we live right here and then the way that we think about what happens in the heavens. Yeah, so religion, actually like faith, was a kind of a vertical thing and a horizontal thing, and it permeated everything of life. So our understanding of the cosmos, our understanding of life here, understanding of who we are ourselves, everything was permeated by religion. So some people call this, and he called this I think as well, an enchanted world. A world that was charged with presences, presences of sometimes divine things, powers, spirits, and all those different kind of things. And it was an open world, where like those presences, those divine divinities, were able to penetrate our lives and affect our lives. Not always in a good way, right? There was a lot of like fear and those different kind of things going on. So people were not living happy lives. It was a lot of like, it was a vulnerable life towards everything that happened in the cosmos. So it was certainly not a closed, a self-sufficient life the way that we understand it right now. Like our bodies are close to everything that happens outside and we're self-sufficient, so to say. So he said there was a very different understanding of how we think about and who we are and how we think about the cosmos, where meaning and purpose and all of that kind of stuff was kind of located, not in ourselves, but was located in the universe, in the cosmos. That gradually changed under the influence of the Enlightenment and other developments. And so you can shift the location of meaning from the world, the cosmos, to basically our own minds. When we think about meaning and we think of purpose, it is something that we make up. It's something that we actually attach to things. You can just shift from like the cosmos, the created order, so to say, where God and some maybe some other divinities are present, to like more like an immanent order, organized and reigned by laws, where God actually doesn't really play a big role in anymore. Yeah, so God could be the creator, he could have started it, he maybe might support it and sustain it, but for the rest, he doesn't really play a role anymore in our ordinary everyday lives. It's the natural laws that basically determine what happens and what does not happen. And so there's also an equation of like the sacred that is present in this world. You look, for example, at church liturgy, the Protestant liturgies have done away with most of the sacred compared to Roman Catholic liturgies. They're so like sterile almost compared to like Roman Catholic cathedrals and liturgies and richness and that kind of stuff. And so all kind of different things. So basically it means that God becomes further and further away, that meaning and purpose is not being found anymore in God and in religion and in the cosmos itself. It's like a charged reality, but it's found out in our own minds and in our own lives. And so you get something that he describes as what he calls a buffer self. You can also almost think about it like a self which is then closed off from reality itself. Yeah, so we're not vulnerable to all kind of deities, vulnerable to all kind of threats anymore, but it's basically, this is us, this is who we are. We're insulated and also isolated from the rest of the world. So we create our own meaning, there's kind of a certain sense of a need for maturity. We need to mature up, we need to grow up, we don't need the gods anymore. Over against the childish fears of the medieval times and sentimentality of religiosity. So it's this new stance towards reality, and it develops over and over time to something where we are right now, right? Where most people don't have any notion of the sacred in their own lives anymore. And we just think that we can control our whole lives just by money. We can just buy happiness, we can buy everything that we want. And we don't feel vulnerable anymore to any of the forces or presences that could be anywhere in this universe. We are ourselves, and we have matured, we have grown up, compared to a couple of hundred years ago. That's in a similar stance that Sean Carroll also talks about. So this is a quote from his book, The Big Picture. And he says this, facing up to reality, it's not coming through. All right, we'll switch on from...
Just
there's a delay in that. This is what he says. Facing up to reality can make us feel the need for some existential therapy. We're floating in a purposeless cosmos, confronting the inevitability of death, wondering what any of it means. But we're only adrift if we choose to be. Humanity is graduating into adulthood, leaving behind the comfortable protocols with childhood upbringing and being forced to fend for itself. It's intimidating and wearying, but the victories are all in the suit. Yes, he says, like, there's a sense in which, like, we grow up. We grow up from the medieval times where we basically were, like, in social communities and in connection with God and all those different kind of things. And now we grow up and we discover that we can actually stand by ourselves. We don't need any of that anymore. And we can just be here. We just determine how this world is. We give it meaning. We give it purpose. It's scary, but we can do it. That's kind of how it comes down to. John Taylor says, yeah, that's true, but at the same time, there's also a sense of loss and malaise in this vast universe. So he gave you a quote of Blaise Pascal. Obviously, this is a little earlier than Sean Carroll, but the sense of like being lost in the universe is expressed there pretty well. When I consider the short duration of my life, swallowed up in an eternity before and after, the little space I fill engulfed in an infinite immensity of spaces, whereof I know nothing, and which know nothing of me, I'm terrified. The eternal silence of these infinite spaces frightens me. So that's from Spock says. So there's this sense of loss, and a sense of like malaise in this universe. And Charles Taylor has like all, like the whole part of his book is about how to describe this, how to get a finger on what actually is going on. But there's a sense in which like, the disconnectedness that we feel and experience when we look into the universe and when we find ourselves being lonely, right, buffered, makes that we feel maybe strong, but we've also lost like the sense of purpose and the sense of meaning. The universe is not able to give that to us anymore. We can pretend that it gives that, but when you really ultimately start thinking about this, it actually doesn't give it anymore. So the buffered self only amplifies that when we're sealed off from any insignificance. And then so often the cure is sought in within immanence, so within like this world. So instead of looking for like purpose and meaning again outside of ourselves, we just look in this world for purpose and meaning. So we look for love, for meaning, for significance, we find it in maybe quasi-transcendent things, maybe new age or something like that. And he calls it the agape analog. Basically he says like, it is something similar to basically the agape, like the Christian understanding of like fullness, the Christian understanding of meaning and purpose. But it's not the same, it's kind of an analog, it's like a replacement for it. But it doesn't do it. And a lot of people experience that. When you just walk around on the street and you ask people, like, who are you and where do you find like meaning and purpose? A lot of people have no idea how to answer that question. And they're just lost. And the answer for a lot of people is materialism, consumerism, right? And just buying more because you find your identity in like your stuff. But eventually even that kind of runs out and you're not happy anymore with those kind of things. So it's basically the thing that he traces. He traces this understanding of who we are in this cosmos from like a place where we were connected with the universe, where meaning and purpose permeated everything, and where we found our meaning and purpose and our understanding of who we are ourselves in like this web, this rich web of connections that we have with the cosmos, with God, with communities, and all of that kind of stuff. And he says almost all of that is gone in the age that we live in. So he calls this age is haunted. That's how he calls it. And people are looking for meaning. They're looking then to science to answer some of those questions. So because ultimate questions are asked in cosmology, so hopefully also ultimate answers when it comes to those issues of purpose and meaning. And so I think that's one of the reasons that like cosmologists write books, right? There's a sense in which like there's answers to like purpose and meaning that you can maybe find in the universe. It's kind of going back to this like old picture, but not really. So that's one of them, yeah? So itself, people are hungry for purpose and meaning. They can't find it anymore in their normal or in their ordinary lives. And so they go and turn to scientists, specifically cosmologists, to find those answers. And so, is it a commercial interest? Yeah. Is it something that is genuine?
Yeah, maybe as well.
Okay, so that's the first one. Second one was debunking myths, right? So there's a sense in which, like, obviously Sean Carroll and lots of other cosmologists, they don't believe in God. And so, even though they can still generate some income by writing books about God, there's also a sense in which, like, they just want to enlighten the world with a new vision of the world. A vision of reality that is not based on religion anymore, but it is based on science. And how does the world work? How does the world really work when it comes to when you look around you? And what kind of conclusions can you derive from that when it comes to meaning and purpose? So a lot of those debunking of myths happens at the level of like epistemology and ontology and like the metaphysics, especially ontology and metaphysics. So what is the nature of reality? So I put a couple of them down here. There's a whole list, obviously you can read through all those books and they try to say like God is, or religion is like antiquated because of this, or because of this, because of this. But these are the kind of some of the main arguments. So one of them is that God is not needed. Yeah, you do your science, you think about science and things like that, cosmology, the Big Bang, and then the whole evolution of the universe from the Big Bang all the way to the development of stars and galaxies to the development of life. And nowhere in that picture, God really shows up. So the cosmological argument, for example, someone like William Lane Craig is someone who really brings that argument forward. And a lot of people say, like, we don't really care because, like, the whole argument is based on the fact that the universe is a beginning. And they say, like, maybe the universe doesn't even have a beginning. And so there's a sense in which they basically want to say, like, we don't need God in any aspect of this whole reality, in any aspect of explaining this universe. And so, why do you still talk about God? Let's just get rid of it. Order of the universe, then, can be explained through naturalism. Sean Carroll calls it the core theory. And so, it's not only the evolution of the universe, but also how the universe kind of works right now. So all the forces that we have right here, so in kind of like normal physics, you would call gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak force, and those kind of forces. You can bring that together in like unified theories, like quantum chromodynamics. Some people work with string theory and theory and all those different kind of things. And none of those places, God shows up. You can write down a whole equation. God is not in that. And so they said, like, because God isn't in there, why do we still talk about him? So let's get rid of it. Then one of the questions that's kind of is open still is the origin of life and the origin of consciousness. So where does life come from? How can you go from like a universe that is like material to a universe that's alive, where there's reproduction and things like that? And how can you go to a universe that's alive, so to say, where there's like living organisms, to a universe that's actually aware of itself, consciousness, and a mind that maybe eventually saw as well. For a lot of people, that's still a question, and I think most naturalists would say, yeah, we don't really have an answer to that. But it's not an unsolvable question. With a little bit more research, probably in the future, we can really solve this question. So they're not really worried about those kind of things, and certainly are not willing to say, like, that is where God acted. And then there's a sense in which, like, there's scientism, where the claim is that science is the only way to true knowledge, right? If you just talk about knowledge in general, what do we know about this world? The real way, or the only way to find real knowledge and really understanding of this world is through science. It's not through religion, because religion doesn't give it to us. It's just science. Religion is outdated, and its claims of how the world works don't even confirm anymore to the most up-to-date scientific insights. So when you start talking about, like, how does this world work, you try to derive, like, something out of the Bible that certainly does not work with the way that scientists and certainly physicists would describe this world. And so if the science of the Bible doesn't work with the science of this world, why would you still believe in the Bible? And so science is the way to true knowledge. It's a much better way. So that's kind of like, it's kind of evangelism, right? It's scientific evangelism, debunking myths and making a good case for cosmology, a good case for science. And so that's one of the arguments, obviously. That's one of the things why people write those books. Cosmologists write this book. So there's kind of debunking God, pushing God to the sideline, saying he's not necessary anymore, we don't need him anymore. Okay, so itself, giving an enlightened view of this world, and then the last one is maybe there is something really there. And so maybe they're onto something. Maybe they don't see it, but they're connecting with something that their eyes maybe are not open to, but there is something there that maybe they need to be open to. So here's a couple of quotes from a couple of scientists who are not even Christians. This is a... when it goes through. Yeah, okay. So here's two quotes, and there's another page of two quotes. As we looked out into the universe, this is Freeman Dyson, and identified many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked together for benefits, it almost seems as if the universe must in some sense have known we were coming. Paul Davies, I cannot believe that our existence in this universe is a mere quirk of fate, an accident of history, an incidental blip in the great cosmic drama. Our involvement is too intimate. We're truly meant to be here. Alan Sandage, who actually became a Christian later in life, I'm not completely sure when he wrote this. I find it quite improbable that this order came out of chaos. There has to be some organizing principle. God to me is a mystery, but it's an explanation for a miracle of existence. Why there is something rather than nothing? Now, Arnold Penn says, astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which is created out of nothing, one with the very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. So here's a couple of like quotes. I'm not going to use this as like an argument or a proof for God, but there's a sense in which like cosmologists, when they think about this kind of stuff, they're sort of like, but there is something going on in this universe that we can't explain. There's something in this universe that is like mysterious to us. There is something that we just can't put a finger on, and it almost looks like that there is some agent who has done something. That's about as far as most people want to go. Now, obviously, from a Christian perspective, a lot of people have picked up on those different kind of things and developed a fine-tuning argument or a design argument for the universe and used them for apologetical purposes. I'm a little skeptical about those different kind of things. I think you can go only so far, maybe about this far, like there's a divine agent, maybe, who has done something. But there's books in Christian circles who have really developed this argument a lot further and trying to make almost like proofs for God from based on the fine-tuning arguments. I call them signposts, like signposts towards maybe like a transcendent reality, something that actually goes beyond just this physical. So what are some of those signposts that we can think about? It's kind of a list of some of the things that you kind of see show up in some of the books and some of the lectures of people. So the fine-tuning of the physical constants and laws, all the physics laws that we have learned before that I just mentioned, and they're kind of fine-tuned respect to each other, so that this universe actually is able to produce life, is conducive for life. The second one would be the fine-tuning of the very beginning of the universe, and especially that the universe starts with very low entropy. That's kind of something very special. You wouldn't expect that, but that's the only way that this universe will function in Big Bang theories that we have right now. And so there's some fine-tuning going on there. The origin of the universe, and the origin of life, and the origin of consciousness. It's like kind of almost like metaphysical boundaries that the universe has to step over to go to the next phase. From nothing to the universe, from the universe, a dead universe, to like a universe where life can be existing, and then from life to something that's conscious. The intelligibility of the universe, the fact that we have a mind that actually can understand this universe. Yeah, that's something that is interesting. That's something that actually Einstein pointed to over and over again, that this universe actually can be understood. There's no reason for that. The fact that we have a mind does not mean that our mind should be able to understand how this universe works. You can go more deeper into that, but the fact is that we can understand this universe, that we can understand the laws, the regularities in this universe, and that we can understand actually how this whole universe works and how it has evolved. And then there's something like a sense of wonder and awe, if this ever shows up. Yeah. For all people, can also just be explained by this plain naturalism. There's a sense in which, like, a naturalist account of this universe, and we'll go a little bit deeper into it in a little bit, finds it difficult to account for things that have no, like, purpose or meaning. So something like beauty, right, is really difficult for, like, just a naturalist to really account for. Why would we have a sense of beauty? Why would we have a sense of wonder? But everyone has it. Yeah, you go to the beach and you see a sunset, and it's universal. Everyone just has something Wow, it's so beautiful. You go to the mountains, you look up at the stars, you go wherever. Like, there's a sense of beauty. You find it in art, you find it in music. Why is this something that people are just really captured by beauty? And purely naturalistic accounts, or a purely naturalistic story, I find it really difficult to account for those different kinds of things. So it's a signpost, what I call it. And then the existence of human beings, souls or minds, morals, the sense of caring, love, and then values like beauty, I kind of mentioned those already. A kind of a rich human experience with every aspect of who we are is something that is difficult again to account for in a purely naturalistic account. But the beauty is, for me as a Christian, is that all of these things you would actually expect in a universe that was created by a personal God. If this universe was created by a personal God, all of these kind of things you would actually expect there. They're an expression of his character, and much more than an expression of like a naturalistic universe that just came here just by itself. So maybe this is kind of like my hypothesis almost, if this one stresses over again. Is it to a certain extent kind of touching on mysteries? When cosmologists think about those kind of things, when they ask the really, really big questions, the existential questions, do they touch upon something about the universe that is mysterious? Something that maybe to a certain extent deeply resonates with them, even though they cannot put any words to it. Something that cannot just be explained by science. And so maybe it's a touching of our true humanity, who we really are, in all our richness, and the true nature of this cosmos, that kind of touches, that we find it difficult to sometimes put words to, but we are captured by it in a certain sense. That's kind of like what I'm thinking about. That even when cosmologists like Sean Carroll and Stephen Hawking, when they talk about this universe, they have this sense like, of beauty and a mystery and a sense of like something that really transcends, even though it's really difficult to put words on that. And then maybe there's a sense of like God, but they don't want to go that far, right? Because you don't want to talk about that, because you don't want to commit to that. But there's still something that captures the imagination, that goes maybe, if you really start probing and start questioning, and maybe it takes years, that they would say, yeah, there's something more. On the other hand, that's my hypothesis. Maybe there is something that touches them in their hearts that they don't even want to acknowledge, but it's still going on there. But here's Sean Carroll again, saying actually, no, probably not. This is what he says. There are biases on both sides. So talking about theism and naturalism. Many people may be confident by the idea of a powerful being who cares about their lives and who determines ultimate standards of right and wrong behavior. Personally, I'm not confident at all by that. I find the idea extremely off-putting. I'd rather live in a universe where I'm responsible for creating my own values and living up to them the best I can, than in a universe in which God hands them down and does so in an infuriatingly fake way. So he says, I understand where you're coming from. I see what you're meaning. Because he actually is quite open to those different kind of things. I find him one of the most respectful scientists and most respectful cosmologists when it comes to science and religion. But he says, like, I make a choice right here, right, not to believe in it. That's kind of what it comes down to. He says, like, based on all what I think about the universe, I actually make a choice not to believe in something like that because I find it just off-putting. To believe in something like that, to believe in a universe that is constructed in such a way. Now, if you read his book, it's a great book to read, so I can recommend it. It's not too difficult, although it'll be challenging here and there. But if you read this book, and you go a little deeper into it, he has like six different parts in his book, and the last part is caring, where he tries to explain why we are human beings that actually care for other beings. And then he has like one chapter where he has like his 10 rules for like good living. Now, that's very interesting, right? Why 10, right? It's almost like Jordan Peterson with the 12 rules, right? But this is the 10 rules, you would think like the 10 commandments. It's actually not. They're actually fairly flat, those rules. They're like on the level of like Oprah Winfrey almost. which is kind of sad, but that's kind of what you get to. So an honest attempt to derive like morality from a naturalistic picture, from a naturalistic worldview, leads to something that is just very flat and not meaningful at all. And actually my students pick up on those different kind of things as well. They read this chapter and say, like, there's kind of a letdown. Like, we had hoped that there would be coming something like a really beautiful vision for how, like, actually you can live as a human being in this world. When it comes to this, like, 10 rules that in the end don't say anything. So, if you boil it down then, it's still a good book. If you boil it down, there's a sense of it's like a naturalistic picture and a choice not to believe in God because it's so off-putting, leads to ideas of, like, there is actually no human agency. And ethics and morals are just a social construct mingled with some basic drives. And then the experience of beauty and things like that, and values, is just a chemical response in our brain that we just experience. But it could have been totally different. And you can come up with a whole other list, but those are the kind of things that I wanted to single out. No human agency. Ethics is a social construct, and beauty is just something like just a response. Now, there's a sociologist, Christian Smith. He has spoken here at Wheaton College. He has done a lot of studies on like youth and why youth are religious or not religious. But he has also all kind of other books. He has a book, Protestant Person, like a philosophical, sociological account of like who are we as human beings. And his latest book, I think, maybe has another book out now already, is To Flourish Destruct, about a personalist theory of who we are as human beings. So, I haven't read the whole book, I actually got only through the introduction, so this quote from the introduction. But what I saw, it's actually a great book that I love to read. So this is what he says in this book. Yeah, it's on page 280, but it's one of the notes. So you think, like, it's not 280 pages of introduction. It's a note to the introduction. So this is what he says. Kind of this approach of naturalism, what basically Jean Carroll describes, also makes irrelevant what nearly all humans in known history take to be the most certain and important about human life, namely the reality of human subjective experience and the power of its substantive content to define and mobilize the living of life, which this model judges as merely an epiphenomenal delusion. What really moves and determines life are the natural physical operation of genes, neurons, and chemicals. That actually is confused nonsense. That's the words that he uses himself there. He says, like, if you just think that this is just like some electron currents going around and some genes and neurons and chemicals, then you just don't understand what really is the human experience, a rich understanding of the human life. The result is a hardcore anti-mentalist commitment that makes inconsequential people's ideas, beliefs, desires, feelings, values, aspirations, commitments, and intentions for understanding humanity. So he says, like, just this idea that you can just derive, like, meaning and purpose and all these different kind of things, human values, from, like, just this naturalistic understanding of reality, leads to an understanding of who we are as human beings that is just totally devoid of everything that we find actually to be important in our lives. So, beliefs, desires, feelings, values. None of that actually can be accounted for in a theory like that. So, he is quite a negative about that. And if you want to know more about that, you can read it. So that's where we are. Would it help someone like Sean Carroll? Would it help like cosmologists? I don't know. How to say this? I think it should. Here's the thing. When you think about this creation, right, when you think about the reality that we live in, the way that we experience it as human beings is like rich, is layered, is like thick, so to say. Thick is a sociological description of like this reality, of like human experiences. It has to do with like who we are, it has to do with like how we experience reality around us, it has to do with human values, it has to do with beauty and relationships and all those different kind of things. And none of those kind of things can be totally captured by a naturalistic perspective. That's what Christian Smith said. So, but it is actually a problem. It's actually a question that Sean Carroll actually wrestles with. So a couple of years ago, he actually had a conference of several prominent naturalists from all kinds of different fields, cosmology, ethics, philosophy, biology, coming together to talk about this problem. Like, why is it so difficult for someone who comes from a naturalistic perspective to really describe this reality in like appropriate terms, to really understand who we are as human beings? And I wrestled with this for days. I don't know exactly what the outcome was, but it's a question that I struggle with. The fact that like naturalism is not able to count and describe like this reality in all its richness. And so I would say, yeah, like when we would talk with cosmologists and we talk with them about like their understanding of this reality, we can press them and press them and press them so far that they probably, hopefully, will recognize that their understanding of this reality actually is not sufficient. There's something more, something deeper, something that transcends or that should transcend this reality and should transcend this understanding of who we are. So here's Tim Keller in his book Making Sense of Goals. He says, if you premise that there is no goal, leads most naturally to conclusions that you know are not true. So hopefully you can eventually, if you can push them there, that you say, like, your premise of naturalism does lead to conclusions that are actually not true about what you experience about your own life. And the moral obligation, beauty and meaning, the significance of love, our consciousness of being a self, are illusions, then why not change the premise? Right? So that's kind of where I thought about when cosmologists talk about goals, when they talk about this reality and the attempt to describe it naturalistically. Hopefully, if they really start thinking deeply and deeply and deeply about this reality, they will run into basically this problem, that the premise does not measure up with reality itself. Reality is thick and beautiful and rich description, the way that we live it, the way that we experience it. Because like a naturalist description, this is a very flat description of this universe. Let's see, I'm going to skip over this one. So Taylor's suggestion, Charles Taylor, going back to him, is there this is growing sense of unease and discomfort in our culture. And hopefully if you can press cosmologists to this unease and discomfort with materialism as well and naturalism. Here we go. Then there's maybe a longing for something different, some longing for something more, like a longing for agency and a really understanding of agency, a longing for ethics, a longing for aesthetics, something that goes against like what I just described with Sean Carroll Kane, like no agency, ethics that are just flat, and aesthetics that are just chemical reactions. So those are it's very interesting, those are the three things that Taylor kind of latches onto and says this is something that a transcendent perspective, an open perspective in this reality can actually account for, and a closed perspective cannot account for those kind of things. So his suggestion is, instead of adopting a closed take on this reality, the buffered self, where there is no God, where there is nothing that can influence anymore, nothing that can penetrate our own hearts and our own lives, instead of adopting a closed take on reality, to adopt an open take, one that's open to the transcendent, one that allows for a certain sense of the sacred and the vulnerability towards our environment. Almost, but not really, going back to the medieval picture, but now in like a modernist picture, right? It's actually something that is really hard, even for us as Protestants. So actually, Charles Taylor is quite critical of the Protestant Reformation when it comes to those kind of different things. So the Reformation emphasis on the ordinary, the eventuation of the sacred of the world. He says like that actually leads to like a universe or an understanding of this world that flattens itself, where there is not, where there's no mystery anymore. In the Roman Catholic tradition, a lot of mystery. In the Protestant tradition, not so much anymore. The purging of all art and beauty out of our churches. Initially, maybe not anymore now, but initially certainly the case. Kind of a pre-strong religion, kind of in the development of science, where a lot of Protestants were involved as well, like a god-like dispassionate gaze to basically this whole reality and this whole universe. But it eventually led to like the discovery of laws and things like that, but also to like a universe where God actually became less and less prominent and less present. And then even something like when I struggle myself is sometimes a commitment to methodological naturalism. So that's one of the things that we kind of do in the sciences, methodological naturalism. So you say, like, I'm not an ontological naturalist, so I don't believe that, I believe that God is here, but methodologically, what I'm doing in my daily practice of, like, doing physics or astronomy or biology, I don't deal with, like, God influencing the whole thing. So methodological naturalism. And I struggle with that sometimes, because, like, it kind of eclipses God's presence and activity in this world, to a certain extent. Because you only talk about just things here in this world, without really accounting for where is God present and how does God actually play a role in this reality. Obviously, there's things that you can do there, and you can think about deeper, but that has been a struggle for me. James Smith, a Calvin philosopher and theologian, somewhere on the border somewhere, he wrote this. He wrote a book that actually like a companion to Charles Taylor, or kind of an introduction to Charles Taylor. Not to be secular. And he says, like, how do you engage people with those kind of things? He says, don't have an argument about the data or the evidences, but rather, so don't use like all kind of rational arguments to try to convince people about like the reality of God or cosmological argument or fine-tuning, those different kind of things. He said it's a lot more appealing to people and a lot more fruitful if you offer an alternative story that offers a more robust, complex understanding of the Christian faith and this reality. The goal of such witness would not be the minimal establishment of some vague theism, but the invitation to an historic sacramental Christianity. So he says, like, Christianity has all the resources, but sometimes we don't use them. Sometimes as Christians we go to like the fields of apologetics and rational arguments for God and against God to kind of try to convince people that they need to believe in God. And he says, sometimes your own life and your own life with God and the way that you actually invite people into that life and show that your life is actually meaningful, full of purpose and rich in all those aspects is sometimes much better for a Christian faith than kind of something like arguments for or against the existence of God. I was talking with my wife about this morning, I think, saying like, you would take like a cosmologist to like one of the big cathedrals in Europe where there's some really, really beautiful music playing, and there would be something, a sense of transcendence, and they would be touched by something like that. Well, if I would take them to my own church and have them listen to a sermon, they probably would not be touched by that. Something like that, right? So invite them to something which is beautiful, and something that appeals to like imagination, and something that appeals to like the transcendence, and to fullness, and to all of those different kind of things. Can especially help to kind of like stir some of that up in a way that some of our rationalistic approaches in like evangelical Christianity maybe don't do that. So, when cosmologists talk about God, I think it does actually open various ways for us to engage them in those kind of questions. So, obviously it sells, right? And obviously there's like this debunking, but I think there's also this understanding of like there's actually for us as Christians, at least for me as a Christian, a rich universe out there which is much better accounted for in a Christian worldview than it's being accounted for in a non-Christian worldview. So various ways. It points to universe that's personal. So our own experiences points to the universe as a personal, because the personal God has created it, and then this kind of the signpost that I mentioned points to the universe as a personal, because the personal God has created it. It points to a rich human experience that cannot be reduced to a materialistic or naturalistic description of who we are. But then obviously there's also challenges to connect to this kind of rich reality. But instead, we're so easily drawn into theological and philosophical arguments. They're okay, but will probably not convince anyone. And often our lives can be described as the buffer itself, right? We have full control still over those different kind of things. We find it difficult to let God speak into our life and to really affect our lives. We find it quite difficult to connect ourselves with transcendence sometimes, the transcendent reality and the fullness of life in Christ ourselves. So I think for ourselves we need to recover some of that. And once we've recovered that, there's a sense in which we can invite other people then into that rich life, and maybe they will be connected, and they will experience some of that as well, more maybe than just rational arguments for the existence of God. So the Cosmology Store podcast, I think they are touching on something, something that they cannot put their finger on. Not always, but not everyone. Some of them make a very stance against God, saying, I don't want to believe in something like this. And others are more open towards the idea, but still are not convinced by anything that I've heard or seen so far. But I think there's openness, but at least in certain people, about God and about cosmology. Okay, that's where I want to close this.
So we've got some time for questions. When we get to about 8:30, I'll shut things down so the people who need to leave can leave, and those who need a cookie can go get a cookie. That's right. Okay. So open it up for some questions for AJ.
Yeah. AJ, I don't know if you know this. Maybe it's your brilliance, the leader's brilliance, or providence, but your topic is exactly right on what 850-some churches are talking about this week.
I know.
In the Explore God.
Yeah. Like this week. About like the existence of
for that.
Yeah.
And the fact that 850 churches cooperated is evidence itself. There must be a God.
So I was in Europe in the fall, and we came back to Wheaton at the beginning of January, and we saw all those signs in people's yards. And we were like, wow, what is that? And so we looked it up. And my wife and I were very, very encouraged by that. Unfortunately, our own church is not participating in that thing. I wish it was, because I think it's actually so important. Those are really big questions that a lot of people struggle with, and a lot of people are very curious about. And the existence of churches talking about those really vital things. I think it was N.T. Wright who said the existence of Christianity and the existence of churches that are alive by itself already is like evidence for the resurrection. I think that's how important it is. That the resurrection, giving new life to people, transforming people's lives, but also giving new life to churches, is basically that's a point of evidence for the reality of the resurrection. Yeah. Which means the reality of the transcendent, which means the reality of God himself. So, yeah. Yeah.
Sean Carroll said that in the professional discussions, cosmologists just kind of assumption that it's all naturalism, right? I have a theory that, the reason why we see so much of that in these kinds of sciences is when you're an atheist, if you come in as an atheist, you're just searching for meaning somewhere. But I think that maybe that's why there are so many of those kinds of scientists who are atheists. It's like way more higher percentage than the population, right?
Yeah, the percentage of atheists in the sciences is quite high, especially around say cosmology.
I think it depends on cosmology and biology.
Yeah, I'm not sure about biology. I don't know exactly what the numbers are there.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you know anything, Ray? Percentage of Christians?
I think it's much lower than some of the other sciences, especially chemistry, physics.
Chemistry and physics themselves have a fairly high percentage of Christians, cosmology actually not.
So we need more Christians in that
field. Biology too, yeah.
No, there are obviously cosmologists, Christian cosmologists. The main person that I know, who is Don Page, he works in Alberta, Canada. He is way up there in his understanding of cosmology, way further than what I ever will be able to read. He's in that sense a peer of Sean Carroll, and converses with them, and does all the theories. But he's even doing Christian. Yeah, I think there's one or two more, but that's at least one person that I know of.
I was curious as an astrophysicist why you don't find the fine-tuning arguments compelling. You don't find them effective, or you don't think when you dig deep enough, they don't hold water.
Yeah, that's a good question. So why don't I find the fine-tuning arguments compelling? I do think that they are, what I said, they're signposts, they make you aware of something. I don't think they can lead you all the way to a proof for God. And the reason for that is that, how far you can go is there's fine-tuning in the laws of physics and in the constants. There's fine-tuning in the beginning of the universe. There's fine-tuning with respect to the development of the universe, for example, the cosmological constant and those different things. But then there's still a choice to be made. A good book would be Geraint Lewis and Luke Barnes. Geraint is an atheist, Luke is a Christian. And so they have written this book, A Fine-Tuned Universe, where they kind of debate each other. They're really good friends. They have like conversations, some of the chapters are like conversations about this. And in the end, one of the conversations about like how compelling is this now, like this fine-tuned universe. Both of them agree that the universe is fine-tuned. Both of them think it's fine-tuned for life to be here. But then it comes down to like, what is your premise? What is your like starting point? And Geraint says like, I don't believe in a God, and so I see this, and there's certain things that I can explain, certain things that I cannot explain. He goes back to the multiverse hypothesis as like a way for him to account for the data. Luke says like, no, I do actually believe in the gods, and I find it a much better and a much richer explanation than your explanation, when he says to Geraint. But both of them realize that actually it's a choice in the end. It is not like a proof, it's a choice. I think that goes pretty well with like, with theology as well. Whose book is that? Albert Walters, who's a theologian philosopher in Canada, he wrote a book about Creation Regate, that's the title, where he says like, your heart, there's kind of two directions in your heart, a direction towards God, a direction away from God. And so there's kind of presupposition, right? There's a certain way, like, if you orient yourself towards God, it makes it a lot easier to believe those kind of things. But there's also, and I think it's biblical, like a turning away from God. Mm-hmm. And so it's difficult to see those different kind of things. And so you cannot, I don't think the fine-tuning argument will really win someone over to say, like, I'm going to change my metaphysical position from God. Away from God, towards God. Maybe for some people it does. But most of the arguments that really win people over are much more personal arguments, and arguments from experience than the reason, than the rational arguments. No, it doesn't say that you can't do it, right? Probably people have been converted because of those arguments. But a much more fruitful approach is like having them enter in the community, experience the grace of Christian, and living in those different things.
So you said something earlier, AJ, about the currently existing universe versus the universe that had a beginning. Mm-hmm. And that's always been one of these things that has confounded me because, as I say to my students, you know, either assumption requires faith, mm-hmm. right? Because if the universe has always existed, well, where did it come from and what does that mean? On the other hand, if the universe had a beginning, but God got it started, mm-hmm. where did God come from mm-hmm. and what did that mean?
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, probably not a good answer for this, but does a Christian cosmologist have a helpful, I mean, is there anything in physics and cosmology that helps to answer that conundrum? Or my answer has always just been, well, it comes down to faith.
Yeah.
You know, you have to pick one side or the other.
Yeah. So when it comes down to the very beginning of the universe, there's all kind of competing theories about actually what's going on there. So the original, like not the original, but like the mature Big Bang theories, for example, from the 50s and 60s and 70s, talked about singularity. So it's a point in time where all the laws of physics kind of break down, but where basically the universe came from. And so that was a very definite moment in time. Several people found that very unsatisfactory because it would indeed mean that there's like something that must have started it because it needs to be caused, right? And so there's a lot of attempts actually to evade that problem of singularity. So have like a universe that maybe is always here, or a universe that's cyclical, or a universe that never really was like one singularity in space and in time, in time specifically. So there's a lot of discussion about that. I don't think there's any agreement on that. What is actually like the right solution for this universe? So would a Christian cosmologist be able to answer this question? No, not really, because even those theories are not theories that can be backed up with physical evidence, so to say. Those are just mathematical theories for what is the possible solution for the evolution of the universe. And so you have, like I said, like there's different solutions for that. But there's no evidence, physical evidence in the universe that favors one solution over another solution.
How about the current sort of consensus among, you know, well-respected, rational, but perhaps atheistic cosmologists? Is there a always been existing versus there was a beginning? Is there a consensus or a more?
No, I think even there, like the opinions vary quite widely. Some people think that maybe the universe came into being, and some people think that the universe has always existed in one or another form. There's always like the vacuum, quantum fluctuations, and things like that. So, Lawrence Krauss' book, The Universe from Nothing, talks about these different kind of things, quantum fluctuations that kind of pop up in the universe. But his nothing is not really a nothing, so there's a little bit of a difficulty there. So, I don't think there's really a solution there. For a lot of people, the fine-tuning itself of the universe, for example, points for them towards a multiverse, and a multiverse needs something like Kerlek inflation. And Kerlek inflation is something that's eternal generally, that keeps on going. And so there's probably, I would say maybe a majority of the physicists or astrophysicists, cosmologists would lean that direction, but not everyone. A lot of people also find the idea of a multiverse quite off-putting, because the question is it still science? Do you still have access to those universes? I was at an astronomy conference a couple of years ago in San Diego. It was a whole like, three-day kind of conference within a conference about this very topic, about the multiverse and fine-tuning. And yeah, there were various positions represented there. Some of the senior cosmologists were very against the idea of the multiverse. Some of the like the Sean Carroll group, like the 40s, 50s or so, they were very much in favor of it. And the young crowds was kind of undecided. So there's like a lot of debate about those different kind of things.
But if the universe is expanding outward, doesn't that only make sense relative to a reference point? And doesn't that suggest the beginnings?
Yeah, that's what you would think. let me see how I'm going to say anything about this. So the universe itself is an object where we think about like a three-dimensional object, right? So the universe, three dimensions, x, y, z, so to say. And then it's expanding into something. But that's kind of a wrong understanding of how like this universe works. It is more like that the universe itself is not expanding into something, it's just the universe is expanding. And everything with it. And does it, if you look the movie back, so to say, right? The return movie, yeah, everything would come back to one point, but it's not necessary that at one point, and at one point in time, is also the very beginning of the universe. Some people say maybe the universe actually came through like a collapse and then expanded again, something like that. So they think about the universe maybe something like this. So it was a prior universe right here, and then a collapse, and then like an expansion again of this universe. So this universe, even though it looks like for us that it came from one point right here, was actually a continuation of a previous universe. That's just one way that you can think about it. So even like turning the movie backwards doesn't necessitate that everything came from one point in one time. And then there's all kind of other theories there of what that one point could be, and was that really a point in space, and space at a point in time, was it a singularity or not, and all those different kinds of things there. Yeah?
There's evidence for the expansion.
There's evidence for expansion, yeah.
What is the evidence for the collapse?
So that would be a previous universe, that's not our universe. And so everything in this previous universe will all went up in fire, so to say. Everything is wiped out, so we have no information or whatsoever access to anything in the previous universe. That's a hypothetical situation.
But then I come up with all kinds of theories.
You can talk about this for ages.
Probably give support to your idea, but I think Anthony Flew might have been one who was at least dragged to theism by the time.
Yeah, he was. That's correct. Yeah.
But I think most people aren't like Anthony Flew. And C.S. Lewis argued that we have inhibitions and maybe these walls we put up, and truth could lead us to, reason could lead us to truth, but it's imagination that brings understanding.
Right.
And so he thought he would pack his writing with biblical principles to get past the watchful dragons of people like you talk about. And it actually has worked with a number of people. I mean, I know you know Francis Collins read his Mere Christianity and got past it, and him. But Holly Ordway is a literature professor at Houston Baptist University, and she was an atheist and teaching Tolkien and Lewis. And she said, "I wasn't ready for William Lane Craig until Tolkien and Lewis prepared my heart." And so they kind of worked together, but it was in the order of imagination and then reasoning.
That's actually a good way of like summarizing the whole thing. So there's a limited way in which you can get with fine-tuning arguments and are those reasonable arguments, as I say. But there's something needs to prepare your heart.
Yeah.
And I like that. I think maybe that's what I was pointing towards, like this preparing of your heart, is like the Christian community and grace and beauty and the richness of the Christian community is something that can prepare your heart where then you find fertile ground for like some of the reasonable arguments. Yeah. That's the way that I would do it. Instead of starting with the reasonable arguments and then seeing whether you can include someone, instead of like...
Yeah. But if I can backdoor an astronomy question, with the multiverse, right? Does the multiverse, doesn't that really only answer the fine-tuning? It doesn't really answer the first, non-cause, first cause, right?
Have correct, you heard? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the fine-tuning does not answer anything about the very beginning of the universe.
Okay.
It only talks about how this universe is right now and why it is conducive for life. So how can it be that this universe is so perfectly created that actually life can be here and that life can sustain itself? Yeah. That is something that's kind of miraculous for people. Yeah. So nothing about the very beginning. First over here and Tom, and then over there.
Quickie, if it takes a leap of faith to believe in Jehovah God and Jesus Christ, and it takes a leap of faith to believe secular cosmology, which is the bigger leap of faith in your opinion?
Now, I think the bigger leap of faith, especially when you take into account like the rich reality that we live in and the way that we experience that, that's actually naturalism. Yeah.
That's where I come down to.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was going to say that when I say to people who talk about a multiverse can be infinite, multiverse, so absolutely anything can happen, right? So, well, wouldn't some of them have produced a being capable of creating a fine-tuned universe?
Yep.
So you come up with God anyway,
yep.
If you're multiverse.
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the arguments I think that Plenty kind of played around with a little bit was that if you can imagine that in one of those universes there was like a God, like an omnipotent and all omniscient being, that he would not only be in that universe, but he would be in all the universes. So then you have like your argument for God there.
We have time for one more question.
Your hand
didn't come up before the others. But.
When it came to her question from earlier about how can you prove that there was a universe that collapsed before that, I saw a program way back in the 1990s where this atheist mathematician became a Christian, and he believed he said there was something about the math that made him believe in God, and it was literally that through the expansion of the universe, it's going to collapse on itself again. Mm-hmm. So some mathematician was saying about how the Bible talks about the end, it's like it's going to come to an end and the new heavens and the new earth will be created again. He said something about his math, about the collapsing of this current. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if that's what people started thinking, is that there was an original universe before that. Because like I said, early 1990s that I saw this program where this guy's like, I know there's a God now because there's going to be this end that's really a new beginning.
Yeah.
I have no idea if that means anything.
So it's an interesting thought exercise. I'm a little skeptical about those kind of things because I don't think the Bible is written for those kind of things.
Yes.
It was more written as a science textbook and prophecy about how the future was going to go.
Yeah.
And it probably was also before like our modern cosmology, so before we understood anything about dark matter and dark energy, especially dark energy, which kind of looks like it's propelling the universe even further outward and faster outward than what the expansion is going is
like
doing.
It's not
right
going to collapse on itself. No,
it's not going to collapse on itself anymore. That was the fear at that time. And that was actually also like Einstein's, one of Einstein's concerns, that the universe is actually not stable, and that's why he introduced like the cosmological constant. And for lots of time, people actually thought like there's basically three solutions for the universe. A universe that collapses in on itself, a universe that always keeps expanding but kind of slows down and kind of like comes like to a still standalone, our universe always keeps expanding and never comes to a still stand. But now we've added a fourth one to it, what most people actually think is true, a universe that expands and actually accelerates its expansion, so it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. So instead of like the collapse, people are afraid now of the big rip, where actually the fabric of space-time is actually going to be tearing because of like the expansion, of the extreme expansion of the universe. I don't think Peter wrote anything about that, so... So I'm always very hesitant to connect like the Bible to those different kinds of things. If people, if it's something that serves people's imagination and they actually come to believe the cause, so
all the better.
All the better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's thank AJ for a very comfortable.